and confident. They are well equipped. The Queen has used the money granted her by Parliament, which was supposed to improve defence against the French, to pay for weapons and boots for this army. When they are gone, and the dust has settled on the lane, the Queen orders the Prince to go with his nurse, and turns to me. "And now we wait," she says. "But when they find Salisbury and join battle, I want to see it. I'm going out to watch it." I almost think she's joking. But the next day we get a message sent from James Touché to say that his scouts have found the Earl of Salisbury's men and is lying in wait for them near a little village called Blore Heath. At once the Queen orders her horse, as if we're going out on a ride for pleasure. "Are you coming with me?" she asks. "The King would not like you to put yourself in danger," I say, already knowing that the King's opinions mean nothing to her. "He won't even know that I've gone and come back again," she says. "And I've told my ladies we're going out hawking."
"Just you and me?" I ask sceptically.
"Why not?"
"No hawks."
"Oh, come on," she says, as impatient as a girl. "Do you want to watch over Richard and your son, Anthony?"
"We'll never be able to see them," I say.
"We'll climb a tree," she replies, and then steps up on the mounting block, swings her leg over her horse, and nods to the groom to pull down her gown over her boots. "Are you coming? For I will go without you, if I have to."
"I'm coming," I say, and I mount and ride beside her as we go towards Blore Heath.
We are greeted with a messenger from James Touché, who suggests that we might like to go to the church at nearby Mucklestone, where we will be able to see the battlefield from the belfry. The noble lord is arranging a viewing tower, as if for a day's jousting. We clatter into the little village, sending chickens fluttering away from our horses' hooves, and leave the horses at the village forge. "You can shoe my horse while he's waiting here," the Queen says to the blacksmith, throwing him a penny. Then she turns and leads the way to the church. Inside it is quiet and dim, and we take the winding stone stair upwards and upwards to where the bell is hung in the tower. It's like a great watchtower, the great bell behind us, a stone parapet before us. And clearly across the fields we can see the road from the north, and in the distance the trail of dust that is the marching army of the Earl of Salisbury. The Queen touches my arm, her face alight with excitement, and points ahead. We can see a great hedge, and behind it the standards of our army. I put my hands over my eyes and scowl, trying to identify the river's flag, in case I can make out Anthony or my husband nearby. But it's too far to see. Our forces are perfectly positioned. Salisbury won't know they're there, nor in what numbers, until he comes out of the little wood either side of his road, and then they will face him. There is something very dreadful about looking down on the battlefield, as if we were stone gargoyles on the tower, watching the death of mortals for sport. I look at the Queen. She does not feel this. She's alight with excitement, her hands clasped tight together, as the outriders at the front of the York army come briskly out from the wood, and fall back when they see the mighty force before them arranged in battle order on the little hill with a small river between them. "What are they doing?" the Queen demands irritably, as we see a herald ride out from each side and meet in the middle ground between the two armies.
"Parleying?" I ask.
"There's nothing to talk about," she says. "He is named a traitor. Lord Audley's instructions are to take him or kill him, not to talk to him." As if to confirm the instructions, the heralds break off and ride back to their own ranks, and almost at once there is a storm of arrows from the Lancaster side, shooting downhill and finding targets. A sigh,
A defeated sigh comes from the York side, and we can see the men going down on their knees in a swift prayer before rising to their feet and pulling on their helmets. "What are they doing?" the Queen asks avidly. "They are kissing the ground," I say. There is something terrible about the doomed men putting their lips to the earth that they think will be their deathbed. They are kissing the ground where they will be buried. They know they will be defeated. And yet they are not running away.
"Too late to run," the Queen says harshly. "We would chase them and kill them."
From our vantage point, we can see that the Yorks are outnumbered by almost 2-1, perhaps even more. This is not going to be a battle. It's going to be a massacre.
"Where is Lord Stanley?" the Queen demands.
"He wanted to lead the attack, but I ordered him to be in support. Where is he?" I look around. Could he be hiding in ambush?
"Look," she says.
The very centre of the York army, where they should be at their strongest, is giving way before the arrows.
"They're retreating," the Queen cries. "We're winning so quickly."
They are. The men at the very centre of the line are turning, dropping their weapons and running away. At once I see our cavalry come forwards and start the charge downhill towards the stream. I clasp my hands together as I see Elizabeth's husband out in front, thundering into the shallow water and riding across, struggling up the steep banks of the far side, just as the York forces inexplicably swing round and run back into the very heart of the battle, picking up their weapons and returning to the fight.
"What's happening?"
Margaret is as bewildered as I am.
"What are they doing?"
"They've come back," I say. "They've turned. It was a trick. And now our cavalry is bogged down in the river, and the Yorks are able to fight them from the bank. They've tricked us off our good position, into the river, and our men can't get out." It is a terrible sight. Our men in battle armour on their metal-plated horses go plunging into the water and then struggle to get up the other side of the stream, where they are battered by the York men-at-arms, wielding great swords, war axes and pikes. The knights fall from their horses, but cannot get to their feet to defend themselves. The horses' hooves crash down through the water to crush them as they struggle to rise, or weighed down by their flooded breastplates they drown, scrambling in the churning waters of the stream. Those who can grab a stirrup leather try to pull themselves up, but the Yorks are dancing up and down the dry banks, quick to thrust a knife in an unguarded armpit, or lean towards the stream to slash at a throat. Or one of the strong soldiers steps into the stream, swinging a great battle axe, and down goes the Lancaster knight into the water, which blooms red. It is a savage muddle of men and horses. There's nothing beautiful about it, or noble, or even orderly. Nothing like the battles that are made into ballads, or celebrated in the romances. It is a savage mess of brutish men killing each other for bloodlust. A few of the Lancaster lords scramble up the bank on their great war horses and tear through the York lines and disappear. They simply run away. Worse, even more of them, hundreds of them, drop their swords point down to indicate they are not fighting, pull up their horses into a walk, and go slowly, humbly, towards the enemy lines.
"What are they doing?"
Margaret is aghast.
"What is my cavalry doing? Is it a trick?"
"They're changing sides," I say. My hand is on the base of my throat as if to hold my thudding heart. I'm so afraid that John Grey may be turning traitor as the Queen and I watch. Hundreds of cavalrymen have turned from our side to the Yorks. Surely he must be among them.
"My cavalry?" she asks disbelievingly.
Her hand creeps into mine, and we stand in silence, watching the slow progress of the horsemen across the battlefield, towards the Yorks, with their standards drooped down low in surrender. Stray horses plunge and kick and pull themselves out of the stream and trot away. But many, many men are left struggling in the stream until they do not struggle any more. John, I say quietly, thinking of my son-in-law at the head of the cavalry charge. For all I know, he is drowned in his armour, and not turned traitor at all. From this distance I can see neither his standard nor his horse. He will leave my daughter a widow and two little boys fatherless, if he is choking in that red water this afternoon. The armies break off from engagement, retreating to their own lines. From the banks of the river, even in the water, the wounded men stir and call for help. "Why don't they attack?" Margaret demands, her teeth bared, her hands gripped tight together. "Why don't they attack again?" "They're regrouping," I say. "God spare them. They are regrouping to charge again." As we watch, the horsemen who are left of the Lancaster force charge once more, down the hill at a brave pace. But still they have to get through the stream. This time, knowing the danger, they force the horses into the water, and then in a great bound up the steep banks, spurring them to the York lines, and battle is joined. They are followed by men who are fighting on foot. I know that my son and husband will be among them. I cannot see them, but I can see the movement of the Lancaster forces as they come forwards like a wave, struggle through the stream, and break on the rock of the York line, which holds and fights, and they slug at each other, until we can see our line fall back, and the men on the wings start to slip away. "What are they doing?" the Queen demands incredulously. "What are they doing?" "We are losing," I say. I hear the words in my own voice, but I cannot believe it, not for a moment. I cannot believe that I am here, high as an eagle, remote as a soaring gull, watching my husband's defeat, perhaps watching my son's death. "We are losing. Our men are running away. It is a rout. We thought we were unbeatable, but we are losing." It is getting darker. We can see less and less. Suddenly I realize that we're in terrible danger, and we've put ourselves here by our own folly. When the battle is lost, and the York soldiers chase the Lancaster lords to their deaths, hunting them down through the lanes, they will come to this village, and they will scale this tower, and they will find the greatest prize of the battle, the Queen. Our cause will be lost forever if they can take the Queen and win control of the Prince and the King. Our cause will be lost, and I will have lost it, letting her persuade me to come to this church and climb up to watch a life-or-death battle, as if it was a pretty day of jousting. "We have to go," I say suddenly. She doesn't move, staring into the greyness of the twilight. "I think we're winning," she says. "I think that was another charge, and we broke through their line." "We're not winning, and we didn't break through. We are running away, and they are chasing us," I say harshly. "Margaret, come on." She turns to me, surprised by my use of her name, and I grab her by the hand and pull her towards the stone stairs. "What do you think they'll do with you if they catch you?" I demand. "They'll hold you in the tower forever. Or worse, they'll break your neck and say you fell from your horse. Come on." Suddenly she realizes her danger, and she races down the stone steps of the tower, her feet pattering on the stone treads. "I'll go alone," she says tersely. "I'll go back to Eccleshill. You must stop them coming after me." She's ahead of me as we run to the forge where the blacksmith is just about to put the shoes on her horse. "Put them on backwards," she snaps. "Eh?" he says. She gives him a silver coin from her pocket. "Backwards. Put them on backwards. Hurry. A couple of nails to each shoe." To me, she says, "If they want to follow me, They will have no tracks. They will see only horses coming here. They won't realize that I was going away. I realize I am staring at her, the queen of my vision, who had her horseshoes on backwards. Where are we going? I'm going, she says. Back to Eccleshell to fetch the prince and the king, and to raise the main army to chase the Earl of Salisbury all the way to Ludlow if we have to. And what am I to do? She looks at the blacksmith. Hurry, hurry! What am I to do? Will you stay here? And if they come through, you are to tell them that I am going to meet my army at Nottingham. You're leaving me here? They won't hurt you, Jaquetta. They like you. Everyone likes you. They are an army hot from the battlefield. They have probably just killed my son-in-law, my husband, and my son. Yes, but they won't hurt you. They won't make war on women. But I have to get away and get the prince and the king safe. You will save me if you tell them I've gone to Nottingham. I hesitate for a moment. I'm afraid. She holds out her hand to me, and she makes the gesture that I taught her myself. The pointing finger gesture that draws the circle in the air, which shows the wheel of fortune. I'm afraid too, she says. Go on then. I release her. The smith hammers in the last nail. The horse walks a little awkwardly, but he's sound enough. The smith drops to his hands and knees in the dirt, and Margaret steps on his back to get into the saddle. She raises her hand to me. A tout à l'heure, she says, as if she's just going out for a little ride for pleasure. And then she digs her heels in her horse's sides, and she goes flying off. I look down at the ground. The marks in the soft earth clearly show a horse coming into the forge, but there is no sign of one leaving. Slowly, I walk to where the track goes through the little village of Mucklestone, and wait for the first York lords to ride in. It grows dark. In the distance at Blore Heath, I hear a cannon shot, and then another, slowly through the night. I wonder that they can see anything to fire upon. Groups of men come by, some of them supporting their wounded companions, some of them with their heads down, running as if from fear itself. I shrink back inside the forge, and they don't see me as they go by. They don't even stop to ask for drink or food. All the windows and doors in the village are barred to all soldiers, whatever badge they wear. When I see a Lancaster badge, I step out into the lane. Lord Rivers, Sir Anthony Woodville, Sir John Grey, I ask. The man shakes his head. Were they on horses? They'll be dead, missus. I make myself stand, though my knees are weak beneath me. I lean against the door of the forge and wonder what I should do alone at a battlefield, and if Richard is dead out there, and my son, and my son-in-law. I wonder if I should go out to the heath and look for Richard's body. I cannot believe I would not know of his death. I would surely sense it, when I was so close to the battle that I could even see the churning of the stream where he might have drowned. Here, the blacksmith says kindly, coming out of his little cottage to put a dirty mug in my hand. What are you going to do, lady? I shake my head. There is no pursuing force to misdirect. The York men are not coming through this way, just the broken remnants of our army. I fear that my husband is dead, but I don't know where to look for him. I am weak with fear, and with a sense of my own lack of heroism. I don't know, I say. I feel utterly lost. The last time I was lost and alone was in the forest when I was a girl in France, and Richard came for me then. I cannot believe that Richard will not come for me now. Better come in with us, the blacksmith says. Can't stay out here all night. And you can't go to the battlefield, my lady.
There are thieves working the place, and they'd stab you as soon as look at you. You'd better come in with us.
I shrug. I don't know what I should do. There's no point standing in the street if no one's going to come past me to ask where the Queen has gone. I've done my duty by hurrying her away. I don't need to stand out till dawn. I duck my head under the narrow doorway of the cottage and step into the small, dark, earth-floored room and the stench of five people sleeping, cooking, eating and pissing in the same space. They are kind to me. What they have, they share. They have a corner of black bread made with rye. They've never tasted white bread. They have a thin gruel made with vegetables and a rind of cheese. They have small ale to drink, which the good wife brews herself. And they give me the first gulp from an earthenware cup, which tastes of mud. I think that these are the people we should be fighting for. These are the people who live in a rich country, where land is fertile and water is clean, where there are more acres to grow than farmers to harvest. This is a country where wages should be high, and markets should be rich and busy, and yet it is not. It is a land where no one can sleep safely in their bed at night for fear of raids or brigands or thieves, where the king's justice is bought and paid for by the king's friends, where an honest workingman is tried for treason and hanged if he asks for his rights, and where we cannot seem to stop a French courtier landing in our own ports and laying them waste. We say that we are the rulers of this country, but we don't make a rule of law. We say that we command these people, but we don't lead them to peace or prosperity. We, their own lords, quarrel among ourselves and bring death to their door, as if our opinions and thoughts and dreams are worth far more than their safety and health and children. I think of the Queen, riding through the night with her horseshoes on backwards so that no one can know where she's gone, and her army laying face down in Hempmill Brook, perhaps my husband and my son among them. The blacksmith's wife, Goody Skellhorn, sees me grow pale and asks me if the gruel has turned my stomach. No, I say. But my husband was fighting today, and I'm afraid for him. I can't even bear to tell her of my fears for my boy. She shakes her head and says something about terrible times. Her accent is so broad that I can hardly make out what she says. Then she spreads a flea-filled rug on a straw mattress that is their best bed beside the dying fire and shows me that I can lie down. I thank her. I lie down. She joins me on one side, and her daughter on the other. The men sleep on the other side of the fire. I lie on my back and wait for the long sleepless night to wear away. Through the night, we hear the clatter of hooves down the village street, and occasional shouts. The girl, the woman, and I cower like frightened children together. This is what it is like to live in a country at war. There is nothing of the grace of the joust, or even the inspiration of great principles. It is about being a poor woman, hearing a detachment of horse thunder down your street, and praying that they do not stop to hammer on your frail door. When dawn comes, the good wife gets up and cautiously opens the door and peers outside. When it seems safe, she goes out and I hear her clucking to her hens and releasing the pig to roam around the village and eat the rubbish. I get up from the bed and scratch the swelling insect bites on my arms and neck and face. My hair is falling down from the carefully coiled plait on the top of my head. I feel filthy and I am afraid that I smell. But I am alive. I didn't stand and misdirect the invading lords as the Queen asked me to do. I hid like a serf in a peasant's cottage, and was glad of their kindness. I ducked out of sight when I heard the horses in the night, and I lay down on dirty straw. In truth, I would have given anything to stay alive last night, and I would give anything to know my husband and sons are alive this dawn. I am fearful and low. I don't feel much of a duchess this morning. The girl gets up, shakes out her petticoat, which serves as both underwear and nightgown, pulls on a dress of coarse fustian over the top, rubs her face on the corner of a dirty apron, and she's ready for the day. I look at her and think of the scented bath that is waiting for me at Eccleshell Castle, and the clean linen that I will put on. Then, before I grow too confident of my own future comforts, I remember that I can't be sure that the court will be at Eccleshell Castle, nor that my son and husband will come home to me. "I must leave," I say abruptly. I go outside, and the smith is tacking up my horse. His wife has a mug of small ale for me and a heel of stale bread. I drink the ale and dip the bread in it to make it soft enough to eat. Then I give them my purse. There is silver in it, and some copper coins, a fortune for them, though it was next to nothing for me. "Thank you," I say. And I wish I could say more, that I'm sorry for the ruin that this king and queen have brought upon them. I'm sorry that they work hard, and yet cannot rise from the poverty of their home. I'm sorry that I've slept on linen all my life, and seldom thought of those who sleep on straw. They smile. The girl is missing a rotting tooth at the front of her face, and it gives her a gap-tooth grin, like a little child. "Do you know the way?" the woman worries. It is all of 9 miles. She's never been so far from her home. "You go to Loggerheads, and they will set you on the road there," the smith volunteers. "But take care. The soldiers will be making their way home too. Shall I send the lad with you?"
"No," I say. "You will be busy in the forge today, I should think."
He hefts my purse and grins up at me.
"It's a good day already," he says. "The best we've had in all our lives. God bless you, my lady."
"God bless you," I say, and turn my horse to the south.
I have been riding for about 30 minutes, when I hear a blast of trumpets and see the dust of a great army on the move. I look around me for somewhere to hide, but this is wide, empty country. The fields are broad and bare, and the hedges are low. I pull my horse over to an open gateway by a field, and think that if they are the York army, or York reinforcements, then I can rein in, sit tight, look like a duchess, and let them go by. Perhaps they will have news of my husband and my boy. When they are 30 miles from me, I can make out the king's standard, and I know that I am safe for the moment as the army comes up, the queen and the king himself at the head. "Jacquetta!" she cries out with genuine joy. "God bless you, well met!" She pulls her horse over to the side of the road to let the army keep on marching past us. Thousands of men are following her. "You are safe," she says, "and well. And the king here is so angry at the death of Lord Audley that he's marching himself to bring the York lords to account." She lowers her voice. "He has suddenly come to his senses and said he will lead the army himself. I'm so happy. He says he will never again forgive them, and he's going to avenge the death of our true friend."
"Lord Audley is dead?" I ask.
I can feel myself starting to tremble at the thought of what her next words might be.
"And do you have news?"
A man from the centre of the knights thrusts his horse forwards and pushes up his visor to show his face. "It's me!" my husband yells. "Jacquetta! Beloved! It's me!" I gasp. He's unrecognizable, as they all are, weighed down in their armour and with helmets on. But he comes forwards, jumps down from his horse with a clatter, throws his helmet aside and pulls me into his arms. His breastplate is hard against me, the greaves on his arms cut into my back, but I cling to him and kiss him and swear to him that I love him.
"And Antony is safe," he says. "And Elizabeth's husband. We all came through scot-free. I told you I was lucky."
"Don't look at me. I must smell," I say, suddenly remembering my clothes and my hair and the raised welts of flea bites on my skin. I'm ashamed of myself.
You should never have stayed there, he says, glancing at the Queen. You should never have been there. You should never have been left there.
Margaret gives him a merry smile.
He's been most angry with me, she says. He's not speaking to me for rage. But see, here you are. Safe now.
I am safe now, I agree.
Now come, come, she urges. We're on the trail of the traitor Salisbury, and we are not far behind him.
We have a wild couple of days riding at the head of the royal army. The king is restored to health by action. He is once again the young man who we thought might rule the kingdom. He rides at the head of his army, and Margaret rides beside him, as if they were true husband and wife, friends and comrades indeed, as well as by contract. The weather is warm, a golden end of summer, and the harvest is in from the fields, leaving golden stubble criss-crossed by hundreds of loping hare. There is a big harvest moon in the evenings, so bright that we can march late into the night. At night we set up tents and camp, just as if we were on an evening hunting party. We have news of the York lords. They've met together at Worcester, and swore a solemn oath of loyalty in the cathedral, and sent a message to the king.
Send it back to them, the queen snaps. We've seen what their loyalty is worth. They killed Lord Audley and Lord Dudley. They killed Edmund Beaufort. We won't parley with them.
I think I might send a public pardon, the king says mildly. He beckons the Bishop of Salisbury to his side. A public pardon, so that they know they can be forgiven, he says. The Queen compresses her lips and shakes her head.
No message, she says to the Bishop.
No pardon, she says to the King. Like a rat outside its hole, Richard, Duke of York, takes his stand outside his own town of Ludlow. He and the two lords, Warwick and Salisbury, take up position just outside the town on the far side of the Ludford Bridge. On our side of the river, the king flies the royal standard and sends one last offer of pardon to any soldier who abandons his loyalty to the Duke of York and comes over to us. That night, my husband comes into the royal chambers, where the queen and I and a couple of ladies are sitting with the king. I have a comrade who served with me in Calais, who wants to leave the Earl of Salisbury and come to our side, Richard says. I have promised him full pardon and a welcome. I have to know that he can trust this. We all look to the king, who smiles mildly.
Of course, he says. Everyone can be forgiven if they truly repent.
I have your word, Your Grace? Richard asks.
Oh, yes. Everyone can be forgiven.
Richard turns to the Queen.
And I have yours.
The Queen rises from her chair. Who is it? She asks eagerly. I cannot advise my friend to come to you unless you yourself guarantee his safety, Richard says tightly. Do you promise him your pardon for serving against you, Your Grace? Can I trust you to your word of pardon?
Yes, yes, the Queen exclaims. Who will join us?
Andrew Trollope, and the 600 trained and loyal men under his command, Richard announces, and steps aside to allow the slim, hard-faced man into the royal presence. And that, Richard says to me as he comes to stand beside me, has just decided the battle. Richard is right. As soon as they know that Trollope has turned his coat and come over to us with his men, the three York lords disappear, like mist in the morning. They slip away overnight, abandoning their men, abandoning their town, even abandoning Cecily Neville, the Duchess of York, the wife of Richard the Duke. When our army pours into the town of Ludlow and starts to strip away everything they can carry, she is standing there, with the keys of the castle in her hand, waiting for the Queen. She, who has always been a proud woman, married to a royal lord, is most terribly afraid. I can see it on her white face, and I, who had to wait in Mucklestone for their victorious army to sweep by, take no pleasure in seeing such a proud woman brought down so low. "You have the keys of the castle for me," the Queen sings out, looking down on the Duchess from high on her great horse. "Yes, Your Grace," Cecily says steadily, "and I plead for my own safety, and for the safety of these, my children." "Of course," the King says at once. "Sir Richard, take the keys and escort the Duchess to a safe place, her children with her. She is under my protection." "Hold a minute," Margaret says. "What children are these?" "This is my daughter, Margaret," Duchess Cecily says. A tall girl of 13 blushes painfully red and curtsies low to the Queen, recovers from her mistake, and curtsies again to the King. "This is my son, George, and my youngest boy, Richard." I would judge George to be about 11 years of age and Richard about 7. They both look stunned with shock, as well they might, for they are boys who yesterday thought their father was heir to the throne of England, likely to fight his way through to the throne, and today find themselves facing the King's army and their father run away. A crash from a house behind us, and a piercing scream from a woman, begging for help as she's pulled down and raped, reminds us all that we're in the middle of a war, talking in a battlefield. "Take them away," the King says quickly. "And your husband has left you here," the Queen torments the defeated Duchess. "Do you remember how you insisted that you be admitted to my chamber when I'd just given birth to my baby? And you told me that your husband must visit my husband when he was ill, in the time of our travail. He forced his way into the Privy Council once, but now we see he just ups and goes. He's present where he's not wanted, but when he's needed, he just abandons you. He declares war and then disappears from the battlefield." The Duchess sways on her feet, her face as white as skimmed milk. Smoke drifts across the market square. Someone somewhere has fired a thatch. The woman who screamed for help is sobbing in rhythmic pain. I see the little boy, Richard, look around at the sound of someone smashing an axe into a locked door, and the babble of an old voice praying to be spared, calling for mercy to someone who's not listening. "Your Grace," I say to the Queen, "this is no place for any of us. Let us leave the lords to regain control of the men and get out of this town." To my surprise, she smiles at me, a gleam of malice that shows clearly before she drops her eyes to her horse's mane and hides her expression. "It's a very blunt weapon, an army of uncontrolled men," she says. "When York raised an army against me, he cannot have imagined that I would bring my army against him, and that it would be like this. He has taught me a lesson that I've learned well. An army of poor men is a terror indeed. He nearly frightened me. He must be sorry now, now that there's an army of poor men tearing apart his hometown." The little dark-haired boy, Richard, flushes in temper, looks up, opens his mouth as if to shout his defiance. "Let's go," I say swiftly. And my husband calls a couple of horses forwards, lifts the Duchess into the saddle without ceremony, settles her children in the saddle before 3 cavalrymen, and we leave the town. As we clatter over the bridge, I can hear another woman scream and the noise of running feet. Ludlow is paying the price for the flight of their lord, the Duke of York. "Yes, but not his death," my son Anthony observes. The 3 of us are riding home to Grafton together, our men straggling down the road behind us. I observe, but try to make it clear that I have not seen, that they are weighed down with loot. Every one of them has some cloth bound tight in his pack, or a piece of plate, or a cup of pewter. They were our tenants, but we put them in the Queen's army, and they fought by her rules. They were told that they might loot Ludlow to punish the treasonous York lords, and we will never muster them to ride out for us again if we spoil their sport, and demand that they hand back the goods they have thieved. While York lives, while Warwick lives, while Salisbury lives, the wars are not over. They're only put off for a little while longer. Richard nods.
Warwick is back in Calais, Richard Duke of York back in Ireland. The kingdom's greatest enemies have returned to refuge, safe in their castles overseas. We will have to prepare for an invasion again.
The Queen is confident, I say. The Queen is tremendously confident. November comes, and still she does not return to London, hating London, and blaming the London ballad makers and chapbook sellers for her unpopularity in the kingdom. Their tales and songs describe her as a wolf, a she-wolf, who commands a fisher-king, a man reduced to a shell of what he should be. The most bawdy rhymes say she cuckolded him with a bold duke and popped their bastard in the royal cradle. There is a drawing of a swan with the face of Edmund Beaufort, waddling towards the throne. There are songs and alehouse jokes about her. She hates London, and the apprentices who laugh at her. Instead, she orders the Parliament to come to Coventry, as if Parliaments can be ordered by a woman like outriders, and they obediently come as if they were her messengers, bound to do her bidding when she orders new oaths of loyalty to the King, but also to her by name, and to the Prince. Nobody has ever sworn loyalty to a queen before, but they do now. She cites the three York lords for treason, takes their lands and fortunes, and hands them out as if it were all the 12 days of Christmas come early. She orders the Duchess Cecily to attend so that she can hear her husband named as a traitor and listen to the death sentence passed on him. Everything the York lords owned, every rood of land, every banner, every honour and title, every purse of gold, is stripped from them. The poor Duchess of York, now a royal pensioner and a pauper, goes to live with her sister, the Queen's loyal lady, Anne, the Duchess of Buckingham, in something between house arrest and torment. A half-life for a woman who was once called Proud Cis, and now finds herself a married woman with a husband in exile, a mother missing her oldest son, Edward, the daughter of a great house who has lost all her lands and her inheritance. Sandwich, Kent, and Calais. Winter, 1460. Richard is ill-paid for warning the Queen that the Warwick ownership of Calais has put an enemy on our shoreline, for as soon as the fighting is done and the peace won, she asks him to go to Sandwich and reinforce the town against attack. "I'll come too," I say at once. "I can't bear you to be in danger and me far away. I can't bear for us to be parted again." "I'm not going to be in danger," he lies to reassure me, and then, catching my sceptical expression, he giggles like a boy caught out in a blatant falsehood. "All right, Jaquetta, don't look at me like that. But if there's any danger of an invasion from Calais, you will have to go home to Grafton. I'll take Antony with me." I nod. It's useless to suggest that Antony is too precious to be exposed to danger. He is a young man born into a country constantly at war with itself. Another young man of just his age is Edward March, the Duke of York's son, across the narrow seas, serving his apprenticeship in soldiering with the Earls of Warwick and Salisbury. His mother, the Duchess of York, held in England, will not be able to get a word to him. She will have to wait and worry, as I wait and worry. This is not a time when mothers can hope to keep their sons safe at home. Richard and I take a house in the port of Sandwich, while Antony commands the men at Richborough Fort nearby. The town is still not recovered from the French raid of only a few years ago, and the burned-out shells of houses are a vivid statement of the danger from our enemies, and the narrowness of the seas between us. The town defences were destroyed in the raid. The French fired cannon at the sea walls and captured the town's own armament. They mocked the citizens, playing tennis in the market square, as if to say they cared nothing for Englishmen, that they thought us powerless. Richard sets builders to work, begs the armourer at the Tower of London to cast new cannon for the town, and starts to train the townsmen to form a guard. Meanwhile, just a mile away, Antony drills our men and rebuilds the defences of the old Roman castle that guard the river entrance. We've been in the town little more than a week when I am suddenly frightened from sleep by the loud clanging of the tocsin bell. For a moment I think it's the goose bell that rings in the darkness of 5 o'clock every morning, to wake the goose girls. But then I realise that the loud, constant clanging of the bell means a raid. Richard is out of bed already, pulling on his leather jerkin and snatching up his helmet and his sword. "What is it? What's happening?" I shout at him. "God knows," he says. "You stay safe in here. Go to the kitchen and wait for news. If Warwick has landed from Calais, get down into the cellar and bolt yourself in." He's out of the door before he can say more, and then I hear the front door bang and a yelling from the street and a clash of sword on sword. "Richard!" I shout, and swing open the little window to look down into the cobbled street below. My husband is unconscious. A man has hold of him, and is in the act of dropping his body to the cobblestones. He looks up and sees me.
"Come down, Lady Rivers," he says. "You cannot hide or run."
I close the casement window. My maid appears in the doorway, shaking with fear. "They have the master. He looks as if he's dead. I think they've killed him." "I know," I say. "I saw. Get my gown." She holds the gown for me, and I step into it, let her tie the laces, and then put on my slippers, and go downstairs, my hair in its nighttime plait. I pull up the hood of my cape as I step out into the icy cold January street. I look around, but all I can see, as if engraved on my eyelids, is the man lowering Richard to the ground, and the fall of Richard's limp hand. At the end of the street I can make out half a dozen guardsmen struggling with a man. A glimpse of his face as he looks desperately towards me shows me Antony. They are taking him on board ship. "What are you doing with my son? That is my son! Release him!" The man doesn't even bother to answer me, and I run across the slippery cobbles to where they've left Richard on the ground like a dead man. As I reach him, he stirs and opens his dark blue eyes. He looks dazed.
"Jacquetta," he says.
"My love, are you hurt?"
I'm dreading him saying that he's been stabbed. "A cracked head. I'll live."
A man roughly takes him under the shoulders. "Carry him into our house," I order.
"I'm taking him on board," the man says simply. "You're to come too."
"Where do you think you're taking us? On whose authority? This is not an act of war. It is a crime." He ignores me. One man tugs Richard's boots, another his shoulders. They lug him like a carcass. "You may not take him," I insist. "He is a lord of the realm under the command of the king. This is rebellion." I put my hand on the man's arm, but he simply ignores me and lugs Richard down to the quayside. Behind me, all around me, I can hear men shouting and women screaming as the soldiers go through the town, taking what they want, throwing open doors and banging the precious glass out of windows. "Where do you think you're taking my husband?"
"Calais," he says shortly.
It's a quick voyage. Richard recovers his senses. They give us clean water and something to eat. Antony is unhurt. We are locked in a little cabin at first, and then once the ship is at sea and the great sail unfurled and creaking, they let us out on deck. For a little while we cannot see any land. England is lost behind us. But then we see a dark line ahead of us on the horizon, and as we watch we can see the squat mound of the city, and on its crest, the round walls of the castle. I realize I'm returning to Calais under guard, as a hostage, to the town that I once entered as a duchess. I glance at Richard, and see that he remembers this too. This is an outpost that was under his command. He was the captain of Calais. Now he is a prisoner. This is the turn of fortune's wheel, indeed. "Take care," he says quietly to me and to our son. "They shouldn't harm you, Jaquetta. They know you and they like you, and they don't make war on women. But the Queen's treatment of the Duchess of York will have angered them, and we are quite in their power. No one is going to rescue us. We will have to get out of this alive by our own wits. We are quite alone. The Duke of Somerset holds Geen Castle. He might come for us," Anthony suggests. "Won't get within half a mile," my husband says. "I have fortified this town, son. I know its strengths. Nobody will take it by force this century. So we are hostages in enemy hands. They have every reason to spare you, Jaquetta, and many a good reason to kill me."
"They can't kill you," I say. "You have done nothing wrong but be loyal to the king from the day you were born."
"That's why I'm the very man they should kill," he says. "It will fill the others with fear. So I'm going to mind my manners and speak gently, and if I have to swear to give up my sword to save my life, I will do that. And," he addresses Anthony, who flings himself aside with an impatient word, "so will you. If they ask for our parole, and for our promise that we never take arms against them, we will give that too. We have no choice. We are defeated. And I don't plan to be beheaded on the gallows that I built here. I don't plan to be buried in the cemetery that I tidied and cleared. Do you understand?"
"I do," Anthony says shortly.
"But how could we have let ourselves be taken?" "What's done is done," Richard says sternly. "These are the fortunes of war. All we have to think about now is how to get out of this alive. And we're going to do this by speaking sweetly, biding our time, and keeping out of a rage. More than anything, my son, I want you to be polite. Surrender if you have to, and come out of this alive."
They keep us on the ship till nightfall. They don't want Richard paraded through the town and seen by the people. The influential merchants of Calais love him for defending them when the castle was claimed by York. The men of the town remember him as a loyal and brave captain of the castle, whose word was law and could be trusted like gold. The troop of Calais love him as a firm and just commander. It was the experience of serving under Richard that persuaded the 600 men to change sides at Ludlow and support the king. Any troop that has been commanded by him will follow him to hell and back. Warwick doesn't want this most popular captain to appeal to the people as he goes through the town. So they wait till late at night and bring us like secret captives into the great hall of the castle under cover of darkness, and the sudden blaze of torches is blindingly bright after the black streets outside. They bring us through the gateway, under the stone arch, and then into the great hall, with blazing fires at either end and the men of the garrison at the trestle tables, uneasy at the sight of us. The three of us stand, like penniless runaways from a war, and look around the great hall, the vaulted ceiling with the smoke-blackened beams, the torches ablaze in the sconces all round, some men standing drinking ale, some seated at dining trestle tables, and some rising to their feet at the sight of my husband and pulling off their caps. At the top of the hall, the Earl of Salisbury, his son, the Earl of Warwick, and the young Edward, Earl of March, son of Richard, Duke of York, sit at the head table, raised on the dais, the white rose of York on a banner behind them. "We have taken you as prisoners of war, and will consider your parole," the Earl of Warwick starts, solemn as a judge from his seat at the head table. "It was not an act of war, since I am under the command of the King of England. An act against me is an act of rebellion and treason against my king," Richard says, his deep voice very strong and loud in the hall. The men stiffen at the note of absolute defiance. "And I warn you that anyone who lays a hand on me or my son or on my wife is guilty of rebellion and treason and illegal assault. Anyone who harms my wife is, of course, not worthy of his spurs nor of his name. If you make war on a woman, you are no better than a savage, and should be thrown down like one. Your name will be defamed forever. I would pity a man who insulted my wife, a royal duchess, and an heiress of the House of Luxembourg. Her name and her reputation must protect her wherever she goes. My son is under my protection and under hers, a loyal subject of an ordained king. We three are all loyal subjects of the king and should be free to go our own ways. I demand safe passage to England for the three of us. In the name of the King of England, I demand it."
"So much for the soft answer that turneth away wrath," Antony says quietly to me. "So much for surrender and parole. My God, look at Salisbury's face." The old Earl looks likely to explode.
"You," he bellows, "you dare to speak to me like this?"
The York lords are seated high on the dais, and Richard has to look up at them. They rise from their chairs and glower down at him. He is utterly unrepentant. He walks towards the stage and stands, his hands on his hips.
"Aye, of course. Why not? You don't even deserve to be in our company. You have no right even to speak without being spoken to. We are of a blood royal, and you are a nobody."
"I am a peer of England, and I have served under my king in France and Calais and England, and never disobeyed him or betrayed him," Richard says very loudly and clearly.
"Unlike them," Antony supplements gleefully to me.
"You are an upstart nobody, the son of a groom of the household," Warwick shouts. "A nothing. You wouldn't even be here if it was not for your marriage."
"The Duchess demeaned herself," young Edward of March says. I see Antony stiffen at the insult from a youth of his own age.
"She lowered herself to you, and you raised yourself only by her. They say she's a witch, who inspired you to the sin of lust."
"Before God, this is unbearable," Antony swears. He plunges forward, and I snatch at his arm.
"Don't you dare move, or I will stab you myself," I say furiously. "Don't you dare say a thing or do a thing. Stand still, boy."
"What? You are not fit to come among us," Salisbury says. "You are not fit to keep company."
"I see what they're doing. They're hoping you will lose your temper," I tell him. "They're hoping you will attack them, and then they can cut you down. Remember what your father said. Stay calm."
"They insult you."
Antony is sweating with rage. "Look at me," I demand. He darts a fierce glance at me, and then hesitates. Despite my hasty words to him, my face is utterly calm, and I am smiling. "I was not the woman left in Ludlow Marketplace when my husband ran away," I say to him in a rapid whisper. "I was the daughter of the Count of Luxembourg when Cecily Neville was nothing more than a pretty girl in a northern castle. I am the descendant of the goddess Melusina. You are my son. We come from a line of nobles who trace their line back to a goddess. They can say what they like behind my back. They can say it to my face. I know who I am. I know what you were born to be. And it is more, far more, than they." Antony hesitates. "Smile," I command him.
"What?"
"Smile at them." He raises his head. He can hardly twist his face into a smile, but he does it.
"You have no pride," Edward of March spits at him. "There's nothing here to smile at. Antony inclines his head slightly, as if accepting a great compliment.
"You let me speak like this of your own mother, before her very face," Edward demands, his